Beer, Cheese, and Murder is a true crime podcast about Wisconsin from Wisconsin. Due to the nature of true crime, this podcast contains explicit and graphic content which may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Beer, Cheese, and Murder. I'm Erica, and joining me today are...
Annie.
Dina.
And apparently no one else.
That's scary.
No, I keep freezing up. Sorry.
Just freezing. So
I'm trying to pedal fast.
Oh, we tried to go in alphabetical order and Jill kind of froze, so Terry was on pause there for a minute. But all right, so we've got myself, Erica, Bonnie, Dina, Jill, and Terry, just to kind of recap for everybody listening. So
Jill's having a few computer issues, so
it's Monday,
seriously,
technical difficulties. But all right, all the more reason to drink, right?
Fair enough.
So for this episode, I'm highlighting the Dirt Brown Ale from Driftless Brewing Company, which actually I wish I would have found when we did the episode on Claire Olson, because that was in the Driftless region.
Oh.
But better late than never, right? So we have the Dirt Brown Ale from Driftless Brewing Company, which is out of Soldiers Grove, Wisconsin. It's about 5.5 ABV. And it has, in the description, it says smooth, malty, American brown with notes of chocolate, caramel, and light roast. Just enough flowery hops to lend balance. I'm starting to notice a theme in some of these descriptions with the beers that I choose. There's a lot of chocolate and caramel.
Yeah.
I've been noticing that just in online ads too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, these ones are, I guess, the beers I have been choosing when they're kind of, I consider it sort of mid-range ABV. They're not too heavy and they're not too strong, so it makes it a lot easier to drink it when you're doing something like this. So it works. And then for my snack, I have, it's possible, I think Jill may have highlighted this particular company before, but I have some caramel kettle corn from Pop's Kettle Corn out of Muskego, Wisconsin.
Oh yeah, she did mention that before.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if that's the one that I highlighted, but I have had their popcorn, and yeah. So good. Yeah.
It's really good. Actually, so true story, I was at Total Wine, which I did post on Instagram for it, and I was getting a selection of different beers, and they have some local products by the checkout, and they actually had it there. So I actually bought it at Total Wine.
Nice.
Wow, they're really branching out then. That's great.
Yeah.
So I got it there, and they're on Instagram as at the Pops Kettle Corn. So there's a couple different Pops Kettle Corn, but that's why it's a little different. The Pops Kettle Corn.
And so I'm sorry. I just have to ask, did you see the old fashioned kettle corn or the popcorn by Pops?
They might have had some there. I will say that I zeroed in on the caramel and kind of just went for that.
Of course.
And actually, on the back of the bag, it says, in 2009, Pops Newton started popping his OG kettle corn recipe at locals' farmers markets and festivals. 7 years later, Mark, the sop, son of Pops, took the recipe and, like all good sons, started messing with things, the logo, his flavors, and everything else that his dad created. Now it's an extended family affair that reaches beyond ours to yours.
So, nice.
Yeah, so I can't say I have anything to complain about. It's pretty good caramel corn for sure. And I actually do like even just the original kettle corn also. Anytime we go to a fair or what is it? When the St. Martin's Festival, where shut down the street, like they always have kettle corn and I always have to get some because it's just so good. And these guys are probably the ones selling it.
So. I will be making a trip to Total Wine to check out some Wisconsin beers. So I'll have something for the next podcast. So
yeah, I now have it in my head to go there for like a tasting because one of my employees was telling me how you can get like drunk just going there for a tasting session.
Sounds good to me.
Sign me up. Just kidding, that sounded so funny. Like, oh,
I would obviously do it responsibly, but I feel like that is a good way to test out some things before buying it to make sure that you're gonna like it. So
Total Wine has tastings.
They have a couple of bars. I think they have beers. I think they have wine tastings too. And actually, I think when I went there, there might have been a sign outside about like a wine and something pairing class also.
They definitely have wine tastings, but I didn't know they had beer tastings.
Yeah, I think they have like designated spaces. They even have a couple of like in-store bars, it almost seems like, where you can stop at or at the counter. You can order stuff while you're there. I don't know, I'm never there that long, but it seems like it would be a kind of a fun thing to check out.
Good to know. So.
In the future, to be determined. All right, so moving right along, I'm going to jump into our Wisco fact. And for this case that I selected, we are back in Milwaukee, so I chose my fact accordingly. Some know that Milwaukee was built on swampland, but there is actually a lake underneath the city.
What?
Yep. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Lake Emily is located under the old Northwestern Mutual home office.
Seriously? Right downtown?
Yeah, that's what it says. And it says that the city is working hard to preserve it. Workers check the basement regularly and add water when needed.
Add water to the lake?
Well, it's underground, so I don't know that it's getting how much it's getting like from natural reserves. But that is pretty, it's kind of like cool and creepy at the same time. But yeah, apparently there's a lake underneath the city, which is crazy.
Oh, bizarre. I've never heard that.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the swampland because I live on old swampland. I know for sure.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you're next to such a large body of water, you're going to. It's a fair amount of swampy areas in this part of the state because even near us, there's swampy areas. Mm-hmm. So, but that was a pretty quick and interesting factoid that I hadn't known. So now everybody listening to the podcast now knows it. So now I got to look into that more and see if there's a way that we can see this lake for ourselves. But so as I mentioned, the reason why I chose that fact is because the episode or the case for today's episode is back in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I did a little bit of a different tack this time around. So it's still obviously true crime. It should be a fairly well-known case, at least to everybody on the podcast. And I think even beyond the podcast, but we will find out, won't we?
We will. Now I'm curious.
So this year marked the 20-year anniversary of the disappearance of Alexis Patterson.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Such a sad case.
Yeah.
Wow. 20 years.
20 years. Ooh. Alexis Patterson was born on April 4th, 1995. She was born to parents Ayanna Patterson and Kenya Campbell. In May of 2002, Alexis was 7 years old. She lived with her mother, Ayanna, and stepfather, Laurent Bourgeois, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The morning of May 3rd, LeBron walked Alexis to Highmount Boulevard School in the 4920 or 4,900, I don't know, however you say that, block of West Garfield Avenue near 49th
whatever,
Street.
The whatever block.
It's 4920, but I would say 4900, but then you throw a 20 in there and then I'm like, yeah. I don't know. It's 4920
block, yeah.
So he walked her to school in the 4920 block of West Garfield Avenue near 49th Street at approximately 8 a.m. Alexis was a first grade student there. The school is less than one block from the family's home. So it's very close to where she lived. LeBron said that he watched Alexis walk towards the playground before he headed back to their residence. But Alexis never attended classes during the day. Some of her fellow students reported seeing her crying on the playground before and after school. But aside from those reported sightings, she was never heard from again.
After school, there was one though, huh?
Supposedly, but I also got to question the validity of those witnesses if they're children, because they're so young. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you might have seen a kid that maybe looks similar and just thought that that's what it was. But it's really difficult to say. I feel like child witnesses can be difficult.
Yeah, I guess it just seems odd to me that a child wouldn't go to school all day, but she'd be at the school after school.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So as mentioned, she was 7 years old at the time. She was African American. She had black hair, which was styled in two French braids, which were pulled back into a ponytail. She had brown eyes. And other distinguishing characteristics include a scar right below her right eye, a bump on her left pinky finger, and her primary and secondary teeth were crowded. She's right-handed, she had pierced ears, and she stood about 3 feet 8 inches tall. Obviously, she would be much taller now. But at the time, she was 3 feet 8 inches tall, and she weighed about 42 pounds.
It was really cute.
Mm-hmm.
Cute girl.
Yep. She had been wearing a hooded pull or a red pullover nylon jacket with a gray stripe running down each sleeve, a light purple blouse, or a blue shirt with horizontal stripes. So I actually found different... different article, yeah, different descriptions and articles. So a lot of this information I got off of the Charlie Project. So it's a great site for missing persons. And they actually must have noted that there were different descriptions at times too. So that's why they included both. So they said it was either a light purple blouse or a blue shirt with horizontal stripes, light blue jeans, blue and white high top sneakers, Nike sneakers. And hey, plus, yeah.
The you said the Charlie website, is that like a local, like Milwaukee website, or is that a Wisconsin website?
I don't know that it's
a project that you said.
Local. I think it's I have seen pages for Donna Mae Barrow and then also Alexis Patterson. But I know that the Charlie Project, I think, is more of a national site.
Really?
I'm not sure of the history behind it. It may be somebody that maybe they themselves had an experience with somebody going missing. And so they took it upon themselves to create pages for missing people to have the descriptions and information out there.
Wow. I had no idea there was something like that.
Yeah, I just searched for Alexis Patterson and it was popped up in the search history, her sources of information. So,
wow.
I'd never heard of it either.
Thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
Yep. So she also had cluster type diamond sunflower shaped earrings with yellow gold posts. She was carrying a pink Barbie book bag. And at the time, at least, her nicknames were Lexi and Pie.
Pie, like P-I-E?
P-I-E, Pie. Aww. Despite not attending classes that day, Alexis's parents were not notified until after the school day was over.
Well, that's very disconcerting.
Yeah. Yeah,
that would be like
a grade school.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like daycare would be calling me if the kids weren't there by 10 o'clock.
Yeah, definitely.
And usually it's because we forgot to tell them that they had a doctor's appointment.
They're not going to be there.
But that's why it's like, I know that they're going to call me if for some reason anything were to happen. So
right. They're on it. They have a protocol and a procedure to follow.
Right.
You have to wonder that if the parents would have gotten a call at 8:15 in the morning or 8:30, hey, Alexis isn't in class today. And then someone, well, I walked her there at 8 o'clock. You know, what's going on? Like if they could have gotten the show on the road or, you know, something started a lot earlier than they did.
They handled missing children very differently than they do missing adults. And the sooner you have that, like, you know, that they're missing. I mean, I'm certain that if they had known that, they would have had an Amber Alert. They would have been hours earlier than when they actually noticed or like realized that she was missing.
Well, and good point, Amber Alert. I don't remember when that came into existence.
Oh, long before 2002.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good. Right. Absolutely. Yes. There would have been something like that.
Yeah.
And with the parents living only a block away.
Yes.
Literally would have probably ran to the school and just started looking for her, if nothing else.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That's really, disconcerting.
Yeah. It's very surprising. Now, certainly, I don't think that this is justification for them not finding out until later, but it was initially believed that she may have refused to attend classes because of an argument she had with her mother. So I don't know if it's that the school thought that she had refused, like knew of this argument and thought she had refused to attend class, and so they just assumed she was home. But even so, if that were the case, you would think that they would notify the parents and confirm that, hey, she's not here, she's at home, okay, you know, make sure that she's accounted for. But it also, at the same time, that little tidbit of information doesn't make sense that the school would know of an argument that she had
with her mother. Mom is going to be like, okay, you're mad at me, you can stay home.
How many times have you done that?
Dina speaking from experience.
But you're going to get walked to school.
Right. And so the other piece of it is, if the sighting of her on the playground after school was correct, and she just kind of for some reason hung around school but not going to classes all day, maybe that's why they thought that she had just refused to go to classes. But none of this really makes sense. But the argument
refused to go to classes. She's a child.
She's seven.
Yeah, like, right. You can't just refuse to. It's not like refusing to go to work.
I wish I could do that.
Yeah.
that totally understandable.
Have a job.
But yeah, it sounds like the school really dropped the ball on.
I don't know how large the school is, or I mean, it's Milwaukee Public School System. I know that they have not had the best reputation. So,
oh my gosh, I was just gonna say no more, and then I thought, no, I probably shouldn't say that. But
yeah, I mean, it's
you can edit it out if you feel the need.
No, but I mean, it's a difficult. It's a circular issue, right? I mean, it's, you know, who's really at fault with that? So who knows how, like, what difficulties or challenges that particular school may have faced, the population that it had, what resources it may have had.
And maybe on that one day, you know, maybe the person in charge of doing the follow-ups was ill or something, you know.
Right. And you also don't know what the history that that, you know, what type of attendance issues they may face and what their, you know, what type of dealings they have with parents in terms of how they receive it or how things have gone in the past. I'm sure a number of things led to things being handled that way. And in hindsight, you know, hindsight's 2020, you can look at it and say, like, it should not have happened that way. They should have notified them immediately when she didn't show up for class, at least to verify where she was. So it was initially believed, like I said, that she may have refused to attend classes because of an argument that she had with her mother. So the argument itself was that Alexis had failed to properly complete her homework during the previous evening, and she was not allowed as a result of that to bring cupcakes for her classmates the following day. So I don't know if there was like a special occasion for it as to why she wanted to bring in cupcakes, or maybe she just wanted to, but because of the fact that she didn't get her homework done, her mom's like, nope, you can't, sorry, no treat.
I give that mom credit, because you gotta do consequences and you gotta follow through for bad choices. Otherwise kids don't learn. So as sad as that, or maybe harsh as it might sound to some, gotta give credit.
Yeah.
Right. You're right.
So for the witnesses that saw her supposedly crying on the playground, that may have been why she was crying, because she was upset that she wasn't able to bring cupcakes to school that day.
Poor girl.
Once they did know that she was actually missing and verified that, okay, she didn't make it to school, we can't find her, we don't know where she is, then the surrounding areas were searched immediately after Alexis was reported missing. But again, this could have been hours after she had actually initially gone missing. So it's hard to know how fruitful that search would have actually been. But obviously, you got a missing kid, you're going to do everything you possibly can to find that child. So investigators canvassed nearby Washington Park while divers searched its lagoon. Authorities focused on areas near Meineke Avenue, Vine Street, 16th Street, and 60th Street in the northwest sections of the city. No evidence was discovered at any of the locations. Investigators announced that Alexis disappeared under suspicious circumstances and reclassified her case from a missing child to a criminal investigation by May 14th. So less than 2 weeks later, it was reclassified as a criminal investigation.
Okay.
It was believed that foul play was involved. And the reason why, and I think this is like the big motivation for why they ended up going that route, is because some of Alexis's classmates told police that they had seen a red truck parked near the school for most of the week before her disappearance. The truck never dropped anyone off or picked anyone up, and it disappeared after Alexis vanished and was never to be seen again. So it has not been identified, and it is unknown if it is connected to her case. So it could have been a coincidence, or it could have had some connection. It's difficult to say. But because there was a suspicious vehicle identified around the time of her disappearance, that prompted them to reclassify it as a criminal case. Not to mention, it's been like almost 2 weeks. The seven-year-old isn't going to just disappear and wander off on their own.
Yeah.
Well, and that the truck was gone after the disappearance.
And crazy that a bunch of young kids
noticed
that.
Yeah. Noticed it, yeah.
I'm so bad at that. Like, my surroundings, and it was just talking to me tonight about, oh, did you hear this person laugh? This person's laugh, blah, blah. I'm like, no. I don't even pay attention to that. Like, whatever. Like, I'm so bad,
and I'm a stalker. I'm like always looking out my window every time somebody parks their car, like, whose house are they going into, what's going on. Super nosy.
I'm always peeking out the window at the neighbors, and Sean's like, Erica, come on, people could see you.
You don't have a whole lot of neighbors, Erica.
I know, but still, I've been really nosy about the activity next door.
I don't think it's nosy. I think it's being aware and a concerned citizen and being knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
So there's my little redeemer for you.
There you go.
Well, that, and I feel like every true crime story I listen to starts out with, it was such a nice, quaint little area. Nothing bad ever happened here.
Yeah, that probably might play into your not paranoia, because I don't think you're paranoid, but just to be more on a
more cautious
and aware. Cows show up at their door.
Yes, yes, cows on the door. Yeah, on the doorstep. Yeah, porch.
Not fireworks or gunshots, just cow hooves. Oh my gosh! But all right, so back to the case. So like all investigations, the investigators looked at those closest to Alexis. Police extensively questioned Alexis's mother, Ayanna Patterson, and stepfather, LeBron Bourgeois. LeBron had a criminal record that included involvement in a 1994 bank robbery that resulted in the fatal shooting of Glendale police officer Ronald Hedbany. LeBron was granted immunity in the Hedbany case in exchange for his testimony. During the questioning, he did take a polygraph test and failed after Alexis's disappearance, but he angrily denied any role in Alexis's disappearance. So he has stayed emphatic that he had nothing to do with it. And as we all know, if you were a true crime fanatic like us, polygraphs seem great, but they're inadmissible in court and notoriously unreliable, which is why they're inadmissible in court. So it seems like investigators like to use them to see if they're on the right path or not. But it's like, if the results are, you know,
just because somebody fails doesn't mean they're guilty.
Yeah, I feel like they want to, it almost seems like they have more confidence in the polygraph when somebody fails it than they do when somebody passes it.
Yeah, agreed.
So, you know, it is what it is. So LeBron was charged in 2003, a year after Alexis vanished, as a result of a domestic dispute with Alexis's mother, Ayanna, who had been trying to leave him for some time. So there was a domestic incident with her mom and stepfather.
Like the mom doesn't have enough going on.
Right.
Jeez. So they are married. It's not
it
just
says stepfather. I'm not, I assume they were married. Okay. Yes. Yes. They were married because I have a note coming up that they got divorced. So they were married. He was ordered to stay away from her as a result of this incident. And Ayanna described LeBron as abusive and threatening towards her. Now, it's unclear if this type of behavior existed prior to Alexis's disappearance. Mm-hmm. So it could speak to him being, you know, domestic abuse in the home, possibly. The criminal charges were later dropped and the two divorced in 2005. So
you never know what happens behind closed doors.
Right.
Yeah. So, and LeBron died in 2021 at the age of 52 from an apparent drug overdose.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
So if he did anything, we're not going to hear anything from him about it.
Right. Yep. That avenue has closed. Alexis's biological father also has a troubling criminal history. In 2013, Kenya Campbell was charged with viciously beating his 8-month-old daughter.
Oh my
Stop.
God. Oh my God.
What?
Oh no. Oh no. And I'm guessing this guy is in Milwaukee as well?
Yeah.
Oh gosh. 8-month-old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Viciously.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, trigger warning. These details are graphic and especially difficult to hear in relation to an infant. So, if anybody listening wants to jump ahead a few minutes, We understand, and I apologize for my fellow co-hosts because they have to listen to it. So Campbell woke his mother at about 5 a.m. on November 22nd, 2013, and told her, "Mom, the baby fell." His mother told police that Campbell told her the little girl had split her lip but was fine, and then he left for work, leaving the child with his mother. The mother brought the girl, identified in the complaint only as SM, to a hospital. Although Campbell insisted the girl had merely fallen off a couch, Alice Swenson, a physician at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and a child abuse specialist, told police the girl had suffered abusive head trauma caused by a massive, violent assault that could have easily resulted in death, a broken jaw that Swenson's, yeah.
Oh. 8 months old. Oh.
Yes.
Oh. Holy a split lip, and it, oh yeah, she just fell off the couch and split her lip. No,
he
broke her jaw.
Yes.
Wow. And more, I'm guessing.
Yes. A broken jaw that Swenson said would be extremely painful and carry significant risk of causing brain injury, bleeding on the surface of the brain, or even death. A lacerated liver and adrenal hemorrhage. Swenson said the force required to cause such injuries is massive and involves focal intrusion, such as a violent blow from a fist or a foot.
Oh my God.
I cannot even.
8 months old.
Right.
Oh. Like not even walking yet.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Like maybe not even mobile. At 8 months, not all kids are even fully crawling.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah.
Wow.
A fractured rib and bruises to the child's face, chest, and abdomen.
Okay, I hope this mofo got the electric chair. I know we don't have that in Wisconsin, but.
Yeah, he is not. Other criminal history, according to electronic court records, include a conviction in Portage County in June of 2009 of the manufacture and delivery of cocaine, and in Milwaukee County of marijuana possession and possession of cocaine with intent to deliver in 2004.
And what year was the beating?
2013.
Okay, so this was before.
Yeah.
So he was a drug addict or
he was
a dealer
in dealing, which you'd think that there'd be that more harsher
doesn't
stuff
excuse
going on
it.
That he wouldn't be walking around in 2013, but so be it.
Yeah.
With such troubling history, you also have to wonder if he could have had anything to do with Alexis's disappearance, because obviously he's not opposed to hurting his children.
Right, and don't they always do, like, you always investigate the people that are closest or the family members and whatnot and rule them out.
Yes. However, he was actually imprisoned at the time of her disappearance due to other charges.
Well, good. I'm glad he was in prison.
Yeah. So he does have a pretty solid alibi there. So Campbell was charged.
Can't get more solid than that, really.
Campbell was charged in March of 2002 with repeatedly driving with a revoked license. He posted a $100 bond 2 days before Alexis disappeared, but was released on May 6th, 3 days after she had disappeared. So even though he posted the bond beforehand, it took a few days before it to work for it to work through the system.
$100? What's the point?
I don't even know.
I didn't even catch that. Wow.
Yeah. So one could easily argue that while a monster for what he did to his baby girl in 2013, he is not responsible for the disappearance of his elder daughter, Alexis. In December of 2003, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel published the following article written by Jessica McBride. The photograph of the murdered girl from Georgia looked a lot like Alexis Patterson, who disappeared from Milwaukee last year. Same bright eyes, same broad smile, roughly the same age as Alexis would be today. It turns out that Joella Reeves, 11, was not Alexis Patterson, who disappeared in May 2002 after her stepfather walked her to Highmount Elementary School at 4921 West Garfield Avenue. But the striking resemblance convinced Alexis's family members for days this week that the girls were one and the same, sending the relatives tumbling into a mixture of hope and despair. At the very least, they thought the two girls were doppelgangers. It was something else, Lavoria Akins, Alexis's maternal grandmother, said Friday. It looked just like her. I was just praying it wasn't. Georgia authorities have charged Joella's father and stepmother with tying her up and battering her in their home near Atlanta over the Thanksgiving holiday. The girl was found dead December 1st.
Hell is wrong with people.
I don't know. That's part of the reason why I wanted to read this whole article, because it's just so disheartening that there are multiple people that could do this to children.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Renee Swanson, the lead detective investigating Joella's death with the Henry County Police Department in Georgia, said two Milwaukee police detectives contacted her about the resemblance right after Joella was found December 1st. Swanson said she has a record trail on Joella that dates to well before Alexis disappeared. She lived with her maternal aunt along with another sibling. A relative of Alexis's saw Joella's picture online. The slaying has garnered national media attention, leading Akins and other family members to think the girl could be Alexis. I did think Joella was Alexis, Akins said. The facial, it looked like her, like she was a little older. And with her being gone for a year, kids mature real fast.
Yeah.
Two of Alexis's great aunts went to Milwaukee police with the information Thursday night, not knowing police had already ruled it out. The little girl resembles Alexis so much, it has to be her. They are too identical, Loretta Hubbard, Alexis's great aunt, said before learning it was not. Alexis's relatives were relieved to hear they were mistaken. Oh, Lord, yes, that's good. This was the closest call, Akin said after learning police had ruled out the possibility the dead child was Alexis.
Jeez. That's got to be a tough one for the parents here, you know, grandparents or whoever, that's saying, oh my gosh, I really hope it's not my child / grandchild. But then you're also saying, but now there's another dead child. So that can't feel good either way.
Even no. If,
you know, you don't want it to be your, the person in your family, but then you're knowing that there's another child out there that was.
Yeah, but I got to give credit to the Milwaukee Police Department because they saw the same thing and they took action to rule it out like right away. So by the time her parents had, or the family had come to them saying that they thought there was a strong resemblance, they were able to at least give them the news that it's not her. We ruled it out. Like it's not that. So they're on the case at least. Heart-wrenching to hear of another child being so horribly brutalized, but proving that the little girl was not Alexis gave the family hope that she could still be found alive. In late 2009, the case was assigned to the Milwaukee Police Department's newly formed cold case unit. So now it's 7 years later. Police re-interviewed 65 people who initially said they saw her walk to school. Some of them have since said they may not have remembered correctly and that they may not have seen her that particular Friday morning. So again, if you're interviewing kids that were little, I mean, their memories don't go back that far all the time. LaRon maintained he dropped her off at school. So he stuck with his story that he walked her to school, saw her walk across the street, and then went to go home, and that was the last time he saw her. Police had no physical evidence to contradict what they were told and remained hopeful, like Alexis's family, that she was still alive. By the 10-year anniversary of her disappearance, Milwaukee police had conducted 5,000 interviews and reviewed more than 10,000 pages of information, but had not solved the mystery of what happened to Alexis. Police canvassed her West Side neighborhood, searched nearby alleys, checked vacant houses, searched the area via grids, looked through sex offender registries, checked probation and parole files, executed search warrants, and traveled across the state and even out of state while pursuing leads. Agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation have been involved, as well as the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And still, no luck. Every year since 2012, longtime Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has recognized May 3rd as Alexis Patterson Forget-Me-Not Day. Yeah. In 2016, a tip was called in to police about a woman in Ohio and the possibility of her being Alexis Patterson. The man was the Ohio woman's ex-husband, who, with his fiance, became increasingly curious about the woman's seemingly murky past. Struck by the woman's resemblance to age-progressed images of Alexis, the couple compiled a set of about a dozen photos and sent it to the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office in late June. Days later, they also sent the photos to the Journal Sentinel, which shared the photos with the Milwaukee Police Department's cold case unit. As a result of this information, a DNA sample was taken by Ohio authorities. The results of genetic testing excluded the possibility that the Ohio woman is Alexis Patterson. Alexis's mother, Ayanna Patterson, reacted with grief, rage, and disbelief, as well as sadness for the Ohio woman who, her daughter or not, has endured intense scrutiny by the media and by people living in her small town.
Sure.
She said,
"My gosh, I can't imagine that."
Yeah. She had said, though, she said, "No matter what the test says, I still believe 1,000,000,000% you are my child," Patterson told the Journal Sentinel, speaking to the Ohio woman.
Whoa. Wait, what?
Yeah. So I have thoughts on this, but she has, since this woman was identified, she feels very strongly that it is her daughter, even though the DNA test has ruled it out.
I think there's possibly a lot of just, you know, needing to grab on to something.
Yeah.
And understandably. Yeah. And I mean, that's sad. You got to feel bad for the mom.
Yeah.
And then thinking that maybe, and then not, and then thinking that maybe again, and then not.
Yeah, it's really difficult.
Well, and for the resemblance thing, like not seeing your child for how long and the age progression and similarities, like, right, you probably want to believe that she is okay and she's engaged. Science. Yeah.
Science isn't anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. So as time continued to pass, and we have now hit the 20-year anniversary, there is a belief that Alexis Patterson's mother still holds. As I said, she firmly believes that her daughter Alexis is still alive, and she still believes that the woman in Ohio is her daughter. She has demanded more DNA tests, but those requests or demands have not been granted. So she doesn't think that test was right, and she wants more tests to disprove it. Now,
so, like, I just want to look at it from, what if this is her daughter? Like, why would she not, like, why would she try and fake that it wasn't, that she wasn't the daughter if she really is?
I don't know.
You know, over a cupcake, thing.
Well,
why would they not do the DNA test?
There are occasionally errors in a lab.
Yeah.
There could be. Yeah.
There's a small chance that it could have been incorrectly tested. and that maybe it really is.
Well, but
an adult wouldn't know 20 years later.
In this case, though, I think what the holdup might be, and I don't know for sure. So the first sample was taken by Ohio authorities. So the first DNA sample and test, they must have gotten a warrant to be able to take it from this woman and to do the test. Now, if for some reason that test was wrong, the authorities or the state or whoever would be footing the bill, they may not want to do another test because they trust the results of it. But if the woman who supposedly Alexis Patterson had the same belief as Ayanna Patterson, all she has to do is be willing to do a DNA test. They could go a civil route. They don't need the government to be able to do any DNA test. So if these requests haven't been granted, my guess is that she's unwilling to do a DNA test.
Right. And I guess I just don't understand that if it really was Alexis, why would she refuse to do a test to prove that it was her?
If it is Alexis, she would have been 7 when she disappeared. Right. She didn't disappear on her own. Who knows what she would have gone through.
The brainwashing.
Right. As a result of that.
Good point. So, good point. Yeah.
You know, who knows what she remembers if she doesn't. So it's hard to.
Yeah, that's true.
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
But so she has said, Alexis's mother, I just want the world to be awakened and know that I found my daughter. Believe what I say when I say my baby is alive. That's what I want the community to do. However, officially, Alexis Patterson remains a missing person. And today she would be 27 years old.
Yeah, it's so sad to think about.
Yeah.
So sad. I can picture her picture in the news clear as day. She had the braids, right? With the little beads.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I don't know when the last time was that I saw that, but probably
it did come
sooner
up
than 20 years ago, but.
Yeah, you're not on social media, but it has come up. And I was shocked that it had been 20 years because I remember it. So it doesn't seem like it could have been that long ago.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Heartbreaking. Police continue to receive tips about Patterson. If you or anyone you know might have information, so anyone listening to the podcast, obviously you'd more than likely be from the area, but if for some reason you have any information or think you have any information, you can call the sheriff's office tip line at 414-278-4921. And a $10,000 reward offered by the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office for information that leads to the Alexis still remains open.
I hope she's found. I hope she's found alive, first of all.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens, not often, but it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Currently, there are 149 open missing person cases in the state of Wisconsin. Compared to other states, we sit at 31st for the most missing persons, while ranking 21st for population. So I guess comparatively, not that bad.
Yeah.
Any missing person is bad, but there are some states that have a much higher count.
Yeah, that actually sounded low to me, surprisingly.
Yeah. The dates for cases open in Wisconsin range from 1947 to today.
Wow.
Yeah. Sadly, we may never have answers in some of those cases. And foul play could certainly be a factor in more than a few. Various resources exist to support efforts to finding missing persons. Some of these include the Clearinghouse for Missing and Exploited Children and Adults, supported by the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Sites such as the Charlie Project, which I mentioned earlier in the episode, as I got a bunch of information on Alexis's description for when she disappeared. Various podcasts, including the Vanished podcast, which covered the case of Donna Mae Barrell, the subject of our first episode. So that podcast is almost solely missing person cases. So you can, if anybody has a missing loved one and wants to get that story told just to get more attention to it, you can reach out to that podcast and work with them to get the story out there. Because I believe that's exactly what happened with Donna Mae Barrell. Her, I believe, youngest daughter had reached out to that podcast to get the story told. And while Donna Mae's husband has been charged and convicted for her murder, her body has never been found. And so she does remain among the open missing cases. So she is a part of that count of 149.
Wait, so even though someone was convicted because they don't have a body, that's still considered open?
There's two different cases. There's the missing person case and then there's the homicide case. So they don't necessarily, they're not the same case. So one can still remain open while the other is closed. I don't know.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So I think it's because they want to make sure that they're still looking for her. Even if the case is found, they still want to get that closure. And bring her home. So it helps to make sure that it like if a body is found and they're checking against missing person cases, that it's still there.
Right. Yeah. That's still open.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and many have also gone to social media to create pages dedicated to missing persons cases, whether it be a single case or just a missing person site. There are so many ways to get attention to stuff these days. Facebook has multiple pages. But yeah, it's great that the internet has kind of become as big as it has, because it's a great way to get some of this information out there.
It used to only be milk cartons.
So yeah.
Right. Oh my gosh. Yes. Milk cartons. And I get tax stuff at work, and it has the missing people pictures on the back.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get the what stuff at work?
Tax, like from the government. Oh, okay. IRS or I think it was like IRS documents. Yeah.
Yeah.
IRS.gov.
When you get your free like Tuesday or Wednesday paper in the mail with all the ads and
stuff.
Yes,
that's right. Yes.
Usually the paper that goes around the outside usually has a missing person inside with the age progression photo with it.
Yeah. And that always like, I don't know, weighs heavy on my heart, because like to know that these are still missing people, and some of them with the age progression are 10, 20 years old. Like, this is just a computer generated what we think they could be, and who knows if it's just
it almost like is more sad when years after like a child went missing. Like, I've definitely heard some podcast episodes like this where like years later, decades later, you have that age progression of what you think they look like, and then they find out that the child didn't like just go missing but was murdered. And it's like, you have this image of what they could have looked like,
right?
And you know that they never made it there. It's almost more heart-wrenching from that standpoint.
Right.
Yeah. Over the years, the number of missing person cases have declined with the improvement in communication technology and ability to keep in touch. So cell phones and just the fact that people are constantly in communication with other people. It's not like you only have a landline and you're going on a trip and you have no means of calling back home. So
driving on the road and seeing a license plate or a suspicious car, like, you could actually act on it right then.
And GPS, I mean, it's much harder, I think, to go missing because people are constantly in communication. So that way too, if somebody does go missing, you have a much easier time of pinpointing when it happened or when they were last in communication. So it has helped to bring those numbers down. But there are still mysteries lingering without answers, like that of Alexis Patterson. And in addition to missing person cases, there are also cases of unidentified remains. So one of the same sites that I found that has a list of all the different missing persons in Wisconsin also had, here are like unidentified remains that also...
How does that not match up to anything? It's just someone's not in the system.
Yeah, it could be that. Yeah, it could be that. I mean, there could be people. I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure there are people that are missing that were just never reported missing. Hmm. Oh, or they could be.
How horrid is that?
Well, yeah. Or they could be missing from other states, and maybe we just don't know.
But isn't that why we are cross-referenced? And we have a federal program that
you'd have to, CODIS, depending on the state of the remains when they're found, necessarily be an easy description, and you usually don't necessarily have a DNA profile on file for a missing person's.
Well, you would like to think, really? Because see, I would like to think that if someone goes missing, at least you have like a family member that can give, oh, here's their toothbrush or here's their hair from their hairbrush, but get this in the system so that if you find some remains, link them together.
It could also depend on if it's like a cold case or not. I think these days, if somebody were to go missing, they absolutely probably would collect DNA. Okay.
Sure. But maybe back in the day, that wasn't protocol. Right. And so we didn't know that we would get this sophisticated to figure this shit out.
But also, if you have a family member who is severely into drugs and you get to the point where everybody is just done and can't do it anymore, and you're like, we're done, we're washing our hands of you, the person goes homeless and you never hear from them again, you don't automatically assume that they're dead. You don't automatically assume that if there's a body found, it's going to be them. That person could also have gone to a different state. They find somebody in Wisconsin. It could have been someone from Illinois. It could have been a hitchhiker coming from another area. You know, there's a lot of sex workers.
Good point. Yeah. And you're not going to be, I don't want to say quote unquote proactive, because you don't want to think, oh, this is going to be their demise. So you don't want to be like, oh, here's my drug addict son or daughter's information in case you come across something. No. Yeah. You would never want to do that. So,
but I mean, especially for these older cases, some of them, again, 1947, that's well before DNA technology existed. So even if they do have evidence on file that they could maybe send for DNA tracking, it would probably need to be taken on as a cold case to drive that. So,
can I just say, I'm amazed by any of those cold case, forensic files shows that I watch. Mm-hmm. This is seriously something that has not been solved by pretty darn good detectives, if they're already detectives, and now they're doing this 20, 30, however many years later, and some of them get solved. That is actually mind-blowing, because I just can't believe how detectives and investigators and U.S. Marshals and all those people can have the patience and start the trail and continue and follow it. So,
So I was actually listening to, I'm trying to see if I can find the name of the author, but I was listening to an episode of Anatomy of Murder, and they were talking with this former investigator who has gone on to write a book, and he like literally wrote the book on solving cold cases. So I actually pre-ordered it because you can order it on Amazon. Okay, it's called Solving Cold Cases. Let's see, author is Joe Kennedy.
Was this part of your plan for the podcast tonight, Erica? Or are just rolling with it? I love it. Yeah, like that we're kind of like, she has it at her fingertips, you know?
Yeah, no, it's, so there's a book called Solving Cold Cases, and it's Investigation Techniques and Protocol, written by Joe D. Kennedy and Hogan Hilling. And in Anatomy of Murder, what they usually do for each case is they will interview like former investigators and former prosecutors involved in the case, because that's what the background of the hosts are. So they've kind of got these connections to do that. And they actually were talking with Joe Kennedy about a case that he did. And in the course of the podcast, he actually stated that in 95% of cold cases, the name of the perpetrator is somewhere in the file.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think that I've seen that. Like, it's just something that a minuscule thing that gets quote like overlooked, if you will, but
it's, yeah, it's kind of mind blowing. Like,
I love that podcast.
Yeah. It's a good one. And the episodes are faster than ours. So.
It's because that one's like from the legal standpoint.
It is, know? Yeah.
I like that aspect of it.
Yeah. Paralegal likes the legal aspect.
Right.
Imagine that.
I'm the law, girl. I'm the law.
But yeah. In general, though, you know, speaking of DNA technology, you know, hopefully with the advances in DNA technology, as we've seen in some of our past cases, the unidentified can be matched to the missing and lead to justice. So again, it might take it becoming a cold case, but hopefully there's some form of DNA and file that can be matched up to them and give names to faces or remains. A lot of old remains that are identified. I mean, they recently, I think within the last year, identified some of the victims of John Wayne Gacy. There's also, I think there's a DNA Doe project, and they identified, I think, in Wisconsin in particular, there was a 40-year-old case of a guy that died in a police pursuit, died in a car crash, that was a John Doe for like 40 years, that they were finally able to identify his remains as well. So there's hope. There's always hope. And that is what the high note for this episode is, that there is always hope.
Wow, that was quite the roll into it.
Yeah.
So on the note of the unidentified remains within Wisconsin, as I said, this site that I found, which is actually the Clearinghouse for Missing and Exploited Children and Adults, by the Wisconsin Department of Justice, in relation to the unidentified cases, there is a little blurb here about an unidentified Jane Doe case resolution. So they were able to identify the Jane Doe as Peggy Lynn Johnson Schrader. On July 21st, 1999, a young woman's body was found in a cornfield in rural Raymond, Wisconsin, which is actually not that far.
Yeah,
for years it was unknown who she was and what the circumstances were surrounding her death. In 2019, through the use of forensic genealogy and extensive interviews, this Jane Doe was discovered to be Peggy Lynn Johnson Schrader. On March 16th, 2022, so just a few months ago, Linda LaRoche was found guilty of the first degree intentional homicide of Peggy Lynn Johnson Schrader. So many things.
A woman killing another woman.
Yes. Yeah. So many things go out to the Dreger Lagendorf Funeral Home, Racine County Sheriff's Office, the Racine County District Attorney's Office, and others who helped tell Peggy's story, bring justice to her case, and give her a final resting place. And there's a couple of different links in here. So I have the sources identified on the Beer, Cheese, and Murder website. But if you do click onto this link, there are some additional sources. There's actually two Facebook pages and a Twitter. So again, social media. So there's additional information about the case, and who knows, maybe it'll even be a future episode that we can cover, but it is a good, you know, story to indicate that there is always hope. Even years and decades later, you can still identify the victim or find a missing person.
Advanced technology, and that police are still working on it.
Yeah, and even,
there's all these keyboard detectives too. I mean, you know, people start searching on their own, and it's amazing.
Oh, sure. Yes. And the different organizations that, that are dedicated to doing that kind of thing on their own. Right.
Like, did you watch Don't Fuck with Cats on Netflix? I mean, those people caught a international murderer. Like, it's crazy. Crazy.
I did not watch that. I will have
to. I did not hear of that either.
What'd you say? Don't F with cats?
Yeah.
And it's about a murder?
Yeah.
I would have thought it was like.
It starts with cats.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's very, it's difficult to watch. It's pretty, it's bad. But these people literally, it's amazing what these people did.
Wow. Oh, is this about like the YouTube videos where some guy was like herding cats or something in the videos, and then
he and posting them?
It's kind of hallmark for a serial killer to also harm animals. So I suppose.
Well, right, but really, you're posting it on YouTube and people want to watch that?
Narcissist.
Oh my gosh.
People will watch anything, Jill.
Yeah,
I suppose. See, that's why I don't buy into this.
If I've learned anything from doing this podcast,
social media free.
There's a lot of sick people out there. And I'd like to think there's. There's a lot of sick people out there. Some people are better at hiding it than others, unfortunately. But yeah, but either way, even 20 years later, there can still be justice, as there was in this case. So even if somebody does get away with murder, if you will, for a period of time, that doesn't mean they're going to get away with it forever.
Yep.
Damn straight. Watch your back, you murderers out there still on the loose. Tina's face is like, wow.
Did that come from Jill?
Oh my god.
That was my gangsta scare. Gangsta police scare.
Well, you scared the heck out of me, I'll tell you.
All right, you watch your back.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, no, like the DNA Doe Project as an example, though, that is volunteer. So I've have half a mind to look into it to see if I could even volunteer some of my time.
Expertise. Expertise of true crime love, or I don't know if love is the word.
But that is actually a good point, though. I mean, here we're doing a podcast and it's good for entertainment purposes, but you know, it could be more constructive, right? It's not like those podcasts where you're going and solving the crime. It's not in-depth investigation, but you know, if so inclined and you have the time to do it, putting your efforts towards the DNA Doe Project, you could help identify or solve crimes and bring some closure to families that are in desperate need of it.
Yeah, so you just find some more time, girl.
Yeah, exactly. Because you have.
I can't even believe you.
Sleep is overrated.
Sleep is overrated.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, so that was this week's episode. That was the case this go around. So
I really hope, for the sake of her mother, that something is found out I mean, even if she's gone, I think that, you know, the mom would at least get some closure. She's just got to be able to find out what happened to her daughter.
Something definitive. So sad. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, you just want to know. It's the not knowing.
Yeah.
So
can't imagine,
but there is always hope. So
there is always hope.
Until next like time, eat, drink, and be wary. Thank you for listening to Beer, Cheese, and Murder. We would like to also thank the references that make this podcast possible. A full list of references can be found on our website at beercheeseandmurderpodcast.com. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at beercheeseandmurderpod, where pictures from today's episode are available for your viewing. If you would like to share your feedback, Wisco facts, case suggestions, stories, or just whatever, please email us at contact@beercheeseandmurderpodcast.com. Don't forget to tell your friends, but most importantly, until next time, eat, drink, and be wary.